Hi, you are listening to What's Next. And before we start, I would just like to tell you that this podcast was recorded in June while I was still in Beijing. I will also take the opportunity to mention that I have created a Facebook group for this podcast. Search for What's Next on Facebook, and you are all, of course, welcome to join and to discover who else is listening to What's Next. And now, What's Next from Beijing. Hi and welcome to this edition of What's Next. Today we are still in Beijing, and joining me on the show is Jeremy Goldkorn, publisher and editor at Danway. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And Danway is a blog about Chinese media, advertising and urban life.
That's right. We do a lot of translations from the Chinese media, from the internet, blog posts, and what they call in China BBS, forums, internet forums, and from mainstream Chinese media, and also comment on it, and as well as other aspects of urban China. And we have videos about China, some of them very lighthearted, some of them more serious, but they tend to be about media, architecture, youth culture, urban life.
So why did you quit your daytime job to start a new media venture?
Well, why not?
Why not
is because it's very difficult to make money. It's in China, it's actually illegal to run a media company. So those are some powerful reasons why one might not want to quit one's day job to do this kind of thing. But I also think that it's a great time to be in the media business as an independent entrepreneur, because the costs of production have been basically reduced to the cost of a decent computer and some peripheral equipment. Anybody can do a podcast or a blog or a video that they put online, and we don't need the old distribution networks anymore. So if there's a time in my life when it's a good time to take a risk on a slightly crazy media project, the time is now.
And I think you've been quite successful. Well, I don't know if you're making any money yet, though, but I mean, you have, for example, you have the Sexy Beijing show that's have been quite successful on YouTube. You have hundreds of thousands of viewers.
It's been very successful. I mean, the show is produced by Anna-Sophie Lowenberg and Luke Mines, and we used to run a film production company called Gold Mines together, and they still do that. The show is very, very popular with both Westerners and Chinese youngsters. Some of the shows on YouTube are approaching 500,000 views.
That's quite impressive.
It's not bad. And on there's a Chinese website, video sharing website called 56.com, which has one of the Sexy Beijing episodes that is, I think, now approaching 1 million views. So it's certainly been very popular. As you point out, that doesn't necessarily equate to cash. But that's the
not in this new media business
on right now. So
just to tell the listeners, Sexy Beijing is sort of, can you describe it?
The show stars Anna-Sophie Lowenberg, who's an old colleague of mine from a newspaper I used to do in Beijing. And she is an American who speaks quite good Chinese. And the shtick of the show is basically that she's going around Beijing looking for love, looking for a Chinese boyfriend. But she uses
so this is sort of Sex in the City, but in Beijing. Or?
Yeah, it's a parody. The opening and the music and the sort of the setup with her talking a monologue, talking directly to the audience is a parody of Sex in the City. But the content is actually on the street interviews with Chinese people, and then sometimes interviews with people who know something about China that the show wants to investigate. So it's quite lighthearted, but it's actually very, very informative about urban China. So it's been very popular.
So you have this TV thing, and you have the blogging thing, and then you have a podcast as well.
We've had, I think, so far almost 10 podcasts done by a guy named Robert Ness, who's also an American, actually. And the podcasts so far have all been interviews with people in internet and media businesses, basically. Some other kinds of businesses, but mostly, you know, kind of Web 2.0 type of stuff, really. And Robert has been a student and is considering coming to Beijing now and working more intensely on the podcast. So we might have more of those in the near future.
All right. So this is about you and what you do here in China. And obviously then, since you've been here for, did you say 12 years?
Yeah, since 1995.
Yeah, you know a lot about China and the internet business as well. So what about the Web 2.0
thing in China? Is it taking on, or what's
Web
happening?
Web 2.0 is catching on very big. It's difficult to know what's going to emerge, because there are a lot of copycat businesses, you know, businesses that have been successful in the United States or Europe, such as Flickr and YouTube, are copied very quickly here, and, you know, sometimes adapted. And there are a lot of new ideas too. They're ranging from a local equivalent to Feedburner, to social networking sites. There's a very popular review site, which is sort of social networking, but it's all about reviews of books and movies and other things, called Douban, douban.com, D-O-U-B-A-N.com. You know, MySpace China just launched recently and doesn't seem to be doing very well.
So what about that kind of community sites then, like MySpace or Facebook? Do they exist in China, or?
Well, they are. They're not in the same way as in the US, certainly. I don't know of something exactly equivalent to Facebook. There is, I mean, you know, if you have a Signer account and a Signer blog account, it can seem, you know, quite similar in a way that it is sort of social networking with a number of other functions. MSN is here and is pretty popular among certainly kind of what they call white collar, you know, people who work especially at multinational companies. There is mop.com, which is often hyped as a huge new success, but which I personally think is overrated. It's a mess, I think. The most popular website in China is run by a company called Tencent, and it's QQ.com. QQ started as it got famous and got popular as an instant messaging service, so something like MSN, IM, and it is extremely popular in China with not necessarily the white-collar types who work in multinationals, but the vast majority of Chinese internet users, who tend to be very young and pretty poor, often getting online in net cafes. It's a software. Then around the popularity of it, they've built a portal website. They've built games. They have a virtual currency that you can buy with cash or earn through various games and other things. And you can use that virtual currency or real cash to buy clothes and other accessories for your avatar, which you'll use for instant messaging and other applications in the site. Their forums, their news sites. It's a huge kind of matrix of different sites and services all connected by one brand. So it's not exactly the same. I mean, but, you know, the biggest site, QQ's site, is in some ways, you know, includes social networking as part of all its services.
So what about, I was thinking about, I mean, you mentioned there are a lot of copycats from states or Europe that gets to China, and then I guess there are 10, 15 different versions of the same.
Yes, sometimes
more. Do they survive?
No, not necessarily. I mean, for example, in the wake of YouTube's buyout by Google for $1.6 billion, I mean, before that, it had already been growing, but after that, the number of video sharing sites mushroomed. At one point, there were more than 200. Now, I'm sure many of those have already either switched business models or gone out of business, but there's still at least 20 that are still going, video sharing sites. And, you know, this is a very, I mean, China is a very entrepreneurial country, and the IT industry is more entrepreneurial than most. So people are willing to spend cash and energy on risky internet plays, because if it comes off, obviously, you know, you can be looking at a serious payout. So I think there'll always continue to be a lot of startups in anything that looks as though...
And what about really original things? That's...
What about the original things?
Are there any that's not been seen anywhere else? Sort of.
Well, there are some. I mean, you know, I think the Douban, for example, the review site is really of its own kind. I think QQ, which is the biggest site, although it copies and adapts business models from, you know, other successful companies in other markets, but I mean, as a package, the whole thing is really quite original. So I mean, there are original things for sure, but you know, there's a lot of copying, that's for sure.
Yeah, we are sitting on the rooftop of a Korean restaurant, and there are cars driving by, and if you hear some noises in the background. Let's talk about the mobile web, if there is any in China. I mean, almost everyone you meet here have a mobile phone nowadays.
Well, you can use Gmail on mobile phones here very easily. There are quite a lot of mobile websites, including there's one that has been doing a lot of advertising for the last year called Kongjong, Kong.net, which has a number of applications specifically tailored for mobile. Some downloads, some it's ringtone downloads, it's photo downloads, it's photo uploads. Now they've started a kind of a mobile Flickr type of thing. There's a big problem with mobile in China in the sense that it's still highly regulated. There are basically two official carriers, and the carriers are always trying to use the government to stop small players making money off value-added services, or at least to make sure that they always make the lion's share of the money. So this is hindering innovation. The other thing that's hindering innovation and progress is the fact that 3G keeps on getting delayed here. And it's basically because the Chinese government would like to have its own standard that is in competition to the, you know, for example, CDMA and GSM, TD-SCMA is the local standard. And well, because they don't like paying copyright fees to foreign companies and countries for usage of technologies, and they want to retain a certain amount of independence in what they how they regulate, and which is understandable. The only trouble is none of the competing technologies they've come up with, whether for mobile or for other things such as DVDs, are really very good, and none of even the local mobile operators don't really want to implement them because it's just an expense that there's not really a market reason for it. To sum up, there are lots of regulatory obstacles in the mobile industry that are hindering the development of the mobile web here. I have no doubt that it will develop, but it's more difficult somehow than the internet because there's more control over the access pipes. You know, there's only two operators and they work in cahoots with the government to keep control of what's going on the Chinese, you know, mobile waves. So
I read in your blog a really interesting post about Nokia that had some trouble, but because they didn't picture or represent the Chinese characters correctly.
Yes.
Do you know the story?
Yes, I do. It's a very funny Chinese thing. And I should point out that foreign companies regularly get, you know, bad PR for this kind of thing, whereas Chinese companies don't, even when they do the same things. But basically what it is that on this guy bought a low-end Nokia phone, which has a low-resolution screen, and the Chinese characters don't display properly because it's a low-resolution screen. And he's trying to make trouble for Nokia in accusing them of breaking a law against companies misusing Chinese characters by not writing them properly.
Is that breaking a law in China?
There is, in fact, such a law requiring companies and I think even individuals to, you know, for public signage and that kind of thing, and to use standard Chinese characters. The thing is, with a low-res screen, it's impossible to avoid the problem they were having, and every Chinese digital device manufacturer has the same problem. So it's not Nokia insulting the Chinese people. But it's, you know, there's some guy who's got a bee in his bonnet, nothing better to do, and he's making this fuss. I don't actually think it's a serious worry for Nokia, serious PR worry, because most Chinese people are very practical and they're not really going to care about such a thing.
The story has caught some attention, or?
Well, yes, it's caught some attention. It's caught some attention in the Chinese media, but it's attention. I don't think this thing is going to be taken very seriously by anybody, or at least not by many people.
All right. So what about the blogosphere? There have been numbers of 50 million bloggers or whatever in China. I don't know. Like a huge amount of bloggers. Is that true? Or
It's difficult to know. I mean, I've seen figures ranging in the last 2 years, ranging from 5 million active bloggers to more than 50 million. There's a projection, I think, from a Tsinghua University study that I read recently that projected by the end of next year there'd be something like 180 million bloggers. Well, there's only
80 million. That would be more than the number tenth of Chinese population.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the number of internet users. The latest survey was just under 150 million. So it would be more than the current number of internet users. So it doesn't sound likely to me. You know, I imagine there's probably about 30 million somehow. That figure just seems right to me, but I don't know. 30 million people who actively maintain blogs.
But that's still quite a lot. And also, I mean, the common perception, if you're not from outside China, is that the Chinese internet is heavily regulated. And how does that work with having blogs where you can express your thoughts freely?
First of all, I mean, like in other countries, but perhaps more so, most blogs are really boring accounts of people's personal lives, which the Chinese government doesn't find threatening. How they censor blogs, and in fact the internet in general, is there are a few ways. Number one, sites that are outside China, they can block and filter. A block can take a few forms, but basically if there's a website that they decide they don't like, all the I'm not sure what the technical word is, but all the nodes where China connects to the internet are controlled by the government, and they'll just block websites that they don't like. You can't access them without using a proxy. Then there's keyword filtering, which is quite difficult to know exactly how it's working, but certainly websites that have a high concentration of certain keywords, which tend to be about the Cultural Revolution, the 1989 events in Tiananmen Square, banned cult Falun Gong, and then Taiwan, Tibet, and Xinjiang separatism. Those are the main hot areas. If your a web page contains a lot of keywords about those, it's quite likely that a filtering mechanism in the Chinese kind of backbone internet connection will stop the site from loading. Recently, Flickr was used. A lot of people, there was a demonstration against a chemical factory in the southern city of Xiamen, and a lot of people uploaded pictures as the demonstration was going on to Flickr. It seemed to have annoyed somebody at the internet censor department in Beijing, and they put some kind of filter on Flickr. The site itself wasn't blocked, but none of the photos would load. So that's for sites that are abroad. Sites inside China, any website on a server in China is supposed to have at least one license from at least the MII, the Ministry of Information Industries, which is the government department that controls internet and telecom. Because you have to register for this, the authorities can find you. And if you write things, or if you are, for example, a blog service provider and you host things that people write that the government considers objectionable, they can visit your office and force you to delete the web page. They can send you a notice asking you to delete the web page, or there'll be trouble, which is the most common thing. Or they can just tell you, look, right now, get rid of all web pages that talk about X incident, we're censoring it. And the companies that host blogs will do that because they don't want to get shut down. So, I mean, that's basically how the censorship works. So it's pretty easy to put something up on the Chinese internet. You could put up anything you want onto the average blog provider, but it will get taken down very quickly if it's one of the taboo areas.
So basically you could put anything up until someone discovers it and thinks it's not in the interest of China.
Yes, and that someone could be either somebody in the government, in the various government departments that monitor these things, or it could be somebody at, for example, the blog hosting provider, and they'll see, you know, for example, I upload something about, you know, Tibetan separatism that the government doesn't like, and, you know, they'll see it and they'll think, oh God, we better remove this because otherwise we'll get into trouble. The thing is, the government doesn't always tell you exactly, you know, in fact, they never tell you exactly where the line is. So as a result, people tend to actually self-censor probably a little bit more than they would otherwise, because they don't know where the line is that they could cross.
I heard that many times, that it's sort of random what gets censored officially. And because of this randomness, people are much more cautious
I think that's true, although I don't think random is exactly right, because it's pretty clear what kinds of information they don't want. In terms of sites that get blocked from abroad, it's a little more random. Or at least, you know, it's got some kind of historical reasons that are attached to it.
We have a great example. I don't know if this is true still, I have to try it, but we have this small town in Sweden called Falun. Mm. Which sounds very familiar to Falun Gong.
Is it spelled F-A-L-U-N?
Yes.
Ah, okay. So their websites are probably blocked.
That website is blocked.
Yeah, okay. So that's
and it's I mean, it's really silly to a Swedish person, obviously, because there's nothing there that could harm anyone.
Okay, well, you know what? That is obviously one of the machine-coded blocks. It's a filter of some kind, you know. It just doesn't want to let those words arrive.
But then also Chinese internet users are getting pretty good at avoiding this censorship system.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, young Chinese are like anyone else. They don't like being told what to look at. So, I mean, young, you know, people who are interested in, especially in the outside internet and technology and in the media, will find a way to get around. And it's very easy. I mean, proxy servers work. They get around the blocks. Some of the more popular online proxies, what do you call it, when you go to a web page and enter in a URL and it proxies the website, some of those get blocked. Anonymous has always worked quite well in China, but there was one that was working very well called Proxy, proxzee.com, and that's been blocked. So, you know, it's a game of cat and mouse.
And also, I've seen there are Firefox plugins you could install on Firefox, and then you could easily just...
Yeah, I mean, there's a very good system called Tor. Well, actually, it seems to be too slow to me now, but which is a Firefox plugin. And there, I mean, for example, the recent Flickr block, somebody immediately wrote a workaround and put it up as a plugin for Firefox, so that even though it is sort of filtered in China, you can still see Flickr if you install this plugin.
But what is the general view from the government then on this? I mean, obviously you shouldn't work around the blockings, or do they...
Well, I mean, they are interested in controlling the flow of information, and they've realized that they can't control every drop. But, you know, information that they really don't want circulated in China, they make it troublesome, at least, to get. Not impossible. And if they can make it troublesome to get, it's not going to be... you know, widely viewed in China, and that's enough for them, as far as I can guess after all my years here working in the media, is that it's basically, as long as they can prevent something from being wildly popular and keep it to a minority of people, they're not worried about, you know, it could be as many as 1 million internet nerds in China are looking at websites that they don't want people to look at. Well, that's only 1 million people. That's nothing in China. You know, that's fewer than the amount of people that live, you know, in my district in Beijing. It's not going to be a source of trouble. So, you know, it's not a perfect censorship, and nobody expects it to be, including the government.
Let's talk about, there is this famous Chinese blogger. His name is Sola.
Yes.
And he's sort of doing citizen journalism.
Yeah.
Or what would you call it?
Well, that's what he's calling it. He declared himself to be China's first citizen blogger when he decided to go down to Chongqing, where there was a house called the Nail House that was... the owners had been asked to leave to make way for a real estate development, and they weren't happy with the compensation. So they refused to leave their house and stayed in it, and the real estate development... dug the foundations for the development around their house. So there was a spectacular photo of their house.
Yeah, that photo had traveled around the world, I think.
That's right. And so he went down there with the self-declared aim of being China's first citizen journalist, and he did some video interviews and took photos and wrote something about it. His site got blocked. He's been going around the country basically looking for... hotspots of one kind or another. He hasn't really been doing very good journalism, though, I have to say, since he started. I mean, he goes to places and tries to make a fuss, but it does seem a little bit more like, you know, just trying to make himself famous in some way. I mean, he's not really doing anything that is journalism. He's just going to places where things are happening, demonstrations and stuff, and taking photographs.
But still, isn't that a new thing? Or?
Yes, absolutely. I mean... there's a lot of interesting writing on the Chinese internet now, on blogs and to a certain extent on bulletin boards, where people are criticizing the government, people are asking for justice for something that some wrong that's been done to them, people are debating government policy, people are debating whether or not a chemical factory should be built near their town, and this discussion is happening on the internet in a way that was not even imaginable 2 years ago.
And is that a sign of time is changing, or is it just that right now they can't keep up with the censoring machine, or?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, in the face of the digital onslaught, I mean, censorship is becoming an increasingly difficult thing to do. There are just too many ways to move information around. So that's, I mean, unless they shut down the internet in China, that's unavoidable. And, you know, I think the Chinese government have come to terms with that, because the upsides for them are, you know, I mean, they can't, you can't turn the internet off in China. It would close down trade, you know. So, you know, some of it's the technology has made it inevitable that people are going to start talking. Some of it is that, you know, despite cyclical clampdowns on movements of one kind or another, as China gets richer and as its people get more confident and as the government gets more confident, there isn't a growing space for civil participation in the way this country is run, and that's happening. It's a natural process. It's not happening as fast as the U.S. government would like it to, maybe, but I mean, there is a noticeable and almost daily improvement in the situation of individual rights in China, I think, and that includes the rights to free expression.
I think we're going to finish up quite soon, but I know there, I mean, I have a lot of entrepreneurs on my podcast listening, and some of them might think that, wow, 150 million Chinese internet users or whatever, we should go there and do some business. So what are the common mistakes, or what when people go here and try to adapt their business model to China?
The internet, I think, internet business is like any other business in China. It's very difficult. The regulations and laws are against you as a foreigner. In the internet and media spaces, they're against you even as a private citizen. But there's a very difficult regulatory environment. There are very few industry standards. Chinese internet users as a group at the moment are still very poor. It's an immature market, really. So a lot of businesses that might work in Sweden, the United States, or other developed markets just won't work here because the user base is too poor. It's a country where it's very easy to very easy to get ripped off. It's very easy to get cheated. It's a Wild West type of business environment. The laws, if you actually had to obey all the laws in China as a business, you'd never even open for, you know, the first day, because you can't. So, you know, it's a very difficult place to do business, and the internet in some ways more so than any other place. The upsides are it's cheap to get something going here. If you don't ask for permission, nobody will say no, so you can pretty much start anything you want. You might not be able to finish it, but you can start anything you want. And it's a wonderful, lively entrepreneurial culture where startup business is an exciting thing, where, you know, you can find staff, you can find partners that are enthusiastic about being entrepreneurial. So, I mean, that's something that is truly wonderful. But it's not a place to come and make an easy buck. If you want to be in China, you can be in China. If you want to make an easy buck, then I would go elsewhere.
All right, thank you very much, Jeremy Goldcorn at Danway. And that's a great place if you want to get information about what is happening in the Chinese media landscape. And your web address is, once again,
www.danwei.org.
Thanks lots for coming on the show.
Thank you, Thomas.